This season, let your shoes do the talking. Designer Shoe Warehouse is packed with fresh styles that speak to your whole vibe without saying a word. From cool sneakers that look good with everything, to easy sandals you'll want to wear on repeat, DSW has you covered. Find a shoe for every you from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, New Balance, and more. Head to your DSW store or visit DSW.com today.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Nick Loy. His new book is The Western Front, the first of three volumes of the history of the Great War, 1914 to 1918. The British themselves are a mystery because they put a toe in at the beginning of the conflict. And then what follows is a series of decisions that are both political and military about how to fight and what the aims are. It's striking how it's similar to the putting a toe in 1939 as well. Nick, we need to start with Asquith because he was the prime minister at the time. And Asquith's minister of war was Kitchener. And Kitchener's commander of what will become the British Expeditionary Force that goes to help the French after their attack is John French. Those three men don't strike me as comfortable in the room together. Is that correct, Nick?
That is correct. They are quite individuals of very different temperaments, and they are thrown together. You know, Asquith is, when the war breaks out, nobody understands or has any idea of how terrible it's going to be. Asquith is, at the time of the war breaks out, he's obsessed with a sort of female confidant, Venetia Stanley, that he's, he's very interested in. So he's writing letters to Venetia in the war cabinet. So his focus is somewhere else in many ways. Kitchener is a professional soldier, one of the great heroes of the empire, Kitchener of Khartoum. And, he is very wary of the British getting involved. I think they've got to do something to keep the French going, but how much they're going to do and the sort of strictly limited deployment of the British is always a major political, military, strategic issue, because obviously the British want a small expeditionary force that they can afford, because the British don't have a big army that will do enough to encourage the French, but without really exposing the British to massive engagements that we see with the French and the Germans. But of course, for the French, they have to get as many Brits over there as they can, because their appetite can never be sated. And so this is a constant pull. And Kitchener, who has a global view, the British Empire, there's conflict in the Middle East with Turkey, there's colonial issues, the naval war, is trying to maintain a sort of limited liability to the Western Front. Whereas for the French, they're consistently pestering the British for more and more manpower, more and more troops. What are the British doing? They need to do this, they need to do that. And ultimately, the man who has to manage that on a day-to-day basis is the commander-in-chief of the British Expeditionary Force, Field Marshal Sir John French. Now, French is, I think, in many ways seen as a rather sad character. He comes out of the Boer War in 1902 as a national hero, one of the great British cavalry commanders. He helps to win that war. But he's out of his depth, as many are, in 1914. And he struggles with the scale and intensity of the war. Now, just remember, the British they send to France four divisions and a cavalry division. They have two divisions back home, which they're not sent initially, but they have four divisions. So it's two corps, so it's a small army. At this point, the French have upwards of 80 divisions. The Germans have about over 100. So, you're talking about the British of small fry. And within 18 months, the British have gone to 60 divisions. So the British have gone through a massive expansion. And, French is trying to manage this process. And ultimately, he breaks down at the end of 1915. He's seen so many of his friends killed. He's terrified of the losses. And he is under constant pressure to win decisively or at least win small local victories. And he's also under pressure from the French that think he is not doing enough. So French's position is a very difficult one. And ultimately, he's just not able to continue. So at the end of 1915, he's sent home.
I want to look ahead a few years, 1916, when Asquith steps aside, replaced by the minister in charge of munitions, Lloyd George, the little Welshman, as he's described. The little Welshman is a fighter. Kitchener's gone by that time, and French is gone, and there's a whole new general staff. Is Lloyd George credited with winning the war today, 100 years later, Nick? How is he seen militarily, not just politically?
I think certainly in Britain, he's seen as the prime minister that wins the war. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, he still has a reputation as a man of great energy and determination, a man who has sort of an energy that is really infectious. And so, you know, he inherits a position in sort of the back end of 1916 where the Allies are at a pretty low ebb.
Right.
They fought two terrible battles in 1916 and they haven't really got a lot.
The losses are overwhelming.
Absolutely. So, you know, Asquith is essentially finished by this point. And so Lloyd George comes in and he has to, it's not the same as Winston Churchill in 1940, but there are parallels there really. And, you know, he is the man that ultimately, you know, he's involved in the setting up of the Ministry of Munitions. And, you know, he tries to really revitalize British industry to re-equip the army. But, of course, he has quite poor relations, first of all, with the chief of the Imperial General Staff, Sir William Robertson. And then, of course, with Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig, Commander-in-Chief of the British Expeditionary Force, who replaces Sir John French. And they do not get on at all. There's a fundamental different strategic outlook. And this sets a scene for some quite significant disagreements in that second half of the war. And that, you know, they just don't see eye to eye. So I think the story, as you go through, is one of almost constant arguments.
And doubts and backstabbing. We'll come to Sir Douglas Haig when we go next to the battlefield that Nick has identified in big pieces, dividing the war into three large themes, 1914 to 1915, 1915 to 1917, 1917 to the end. The book is The Western Front. Nick Lloyd is the author.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. With school out, summer is the perfect time to teach our kids real-world money skills they'll use forever. Greenlight is a debit card and the number one family finance and safety app used by millions of families, helping kids learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely. Parents can send their kids money and track their spending and saving, while kids build money confidence and skills in fun ways. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/iHeart. That's greenlight.com/iHeart.